Welcome to the third ScottCast. I want to thank you all for downloading it and listening in. I know you're probably wondering what that piece of music is to, and that's actually to the 2003 computer game that came out for Starsky and Hutch. And when you bought the actual video game, they gave you an actual record LP that had all the music to it. And that was the first track on it, called Bay City Bump. And the music to it is really kind of hip, because you're driving the Torino around catching the bad guys, so all that kind of cool 70s music playing. I don't know who actually performed the music, though. But I welcome you to my third podcast. I do apologize. I thought I'd be doing these more frequently, but I've been busy of late working on some licensing stuff for Shrek 4. So that's been taking up a lot of my time, because they keep changing the script, and we're on the third draft of the script of the movie, and they keep changing some stuff, so stuff I've drawn is now no longer good, or in the movie for that fact, so I don't know what that entails later when I do a lot of this work. I do get paid for it, though, but it just kind of takes more time out of my life to do corrections and stuff like that. But it's all good. It's a pretty cool job, but I'll probably be working on that up until, I don't know, maybe mid-January now, I guess. They just doubled my workload for it, so that's actually kind of cool. I'm just waiting on them currently to get me more reference and also actually specific directions for what they want done. So that's pretty much what I've been working on. Another project I had worked on is for a CSL Behring, which is a pharmaceutical company. I have two characters I created for them, and actually we're just waiting on the final approval for the two calendars that I had done for them. But the one set, one calendar, will feature these two characters, which I'm really kind of excited about, and that should be upcoming hopefully soon. I really hope it's soon. I've been working on it since July, I guess it was. It was when I started it, so it's actually taken a lot more time than I thought to actually get this thing done. So that's pretty much what I've been doing up till now. So it's been pretty, it's been fun. I've had a pretty good year this year, business-wise. So it's actually been kind of cool. In November 21st, which will be like next week, will be my 10th anniversary with Scooby-Doo. And also I have a Scooby-Doo comic, which should be out in December. I didn't do the timing right on that, but the actual Scooby-Doo number 151 will have a story in it that I drew. Today, what I wanted to do was talk about the character design and character design standards. Now, when you deal with character design, it's really a unique field in the animation industry. As most of you know, you really are like the casting director for a TV show or a movie. And a lot of work goes into creating the perfect cast, whether it's for a TV show, an animated show, even a reality show like Survivor. They have to pick the right people they think are going to create some havoc and mischief on it, so they know they're all going to kind of gel and, you know, and make it interesting to watch. And it's the same thing with any kind of entertainment medium. And it really is an art and a discipline to it. And for some artists, it really comes easy, and they can come up with something really unique really easily. And even though there's an underlayer of knowledge and skill that they possess, they really kind of draw on instinct, and their choices are made on a really subconscious level. Some of them have done it for just so long that they're able to create the stuff almost spontaneously, where some of us really have to sit and struggle and do drawing after drawing after drawing after drawing. And really, before you break the rules, you have to know the rules. And a good foundation of basic drawing and breaking objects down to their simplest of shapes is such a key element of creating good, well-rounded characters who are really not only interesting to look at, but are, you know, built well enough so they can be easily animated. And especially turned, because if the turnaround doesn't work, you can kind of notice it on the animation. And that's a lot of problems with today's animation. They go with that really kind of graphic look to them. And some of the turns when they do it, they just don't work. Now, when it comes to the standards for character design, my standards for designing characters are usually these three things. And there are more things that I consider along the way, usually like usage and entertainment medium and ultimate use of the designs, such as if they're going to be mass produced to some kind of a toy or some other medium. You always have to take all these considerations into play when you're creating a design. You kind of know what the end game is. But the first three of my criteria that I really try to meet are clearly just from a visual standpoint. And number one is, it should be something I understand in three dimensions and that I can draw from any angle. It should look appealing from every angle as well. Now, in other words, a turnaround is difficult enough sometimes, and having a really complex character can make it harder to visually imagine from all the angles. Like I say, we'll take Daphne from Scooby-Doo. I mean, a lot of people know the character design through all the years it's been around, but she really isn't that great on the turnaround between the front three quarter and then goes into a side view. The way her eyes are drawn, it's just really not really thought out well. It's like one of the things they did tweak that and fixed it when they did the new version, where they kind of updated the look with Scooby-Doo and the Alien Invaders and Scooby-Doo and the Cyber Chase. They kind of went with a newer look for the characters and kind of updated them a bit. And they did fix a lot of those glitches when they went with the What's New Scooby-Doo look. Then they went back to the old kind of look and designs for the show, and now they're back to suffering with a poor turn. You can kind of see, when you see a character facing the screen, looking at the viewer, and they turn to a side view, you can almost see that middle point where it jumps. It's not a smooth turn. And of course, the simpler your character is, the easier the turn is. The more difficult you make your front three-quarter view, it's going to be a lot harder doing the rest of the turn if it's really complex. And that's the difficulty of drawing Donald Duck. He is quite hard to draw. He might not look it, but he is quite hard to draw. I do have construction sheets for SpongeBob SquarePants, and there's about 7 different sheets for how to draw SpongeBob. That is just on the basic construction theory of the character. He's not just a simple square, you know, with a slight tilt to him. There is so much mathematically kind of thought out in him in terms of design and balance that it will stand out if it doesn't work as well. And that's one of the things that you have to keep in mind when you're designing your character. You want them to be simple and appealing and have enough character that they'll be interesting to look at. And that's really the trick. You don't want to be afraid to draw very little, because then they'll be very boring and bland, yet they'd be easier to animate. You have to find yourself a middle ground. And a lot of times with shows, if they're too difficult to turn or they're too designed with too much detail, then they have to go back in and redesign them to be animated faster. That's another consideration you have to do. If you were, say, doing a comic book, then you could load it up. Then it's all on you as an artist to then have to actually draw it every single panel and every single time the character appears. You have to load up all that detail into them. If you've got a bunch of other people working on it and you got to get this thing done on a certain schedule, a lot of times you have to streamline it down to a basic shape and design, which makes it really kind of unique. And that's really when the silhouette comes into play. Number two, the design should lend itself to expressive expressions and action-oriented poses. Those expressions and poses should be appealing as well. Many times after I do the initial front three-quarter view, I do a quick headshot showing some extreme emotion just to show that the design will work when it's squished and stretched. I make sure that the lower jaw and the mouth work well. And sometimes you have to go back and fix your turns after you do some action poses or some extreme squishing and stretching of the face showing different emotions. You then have to go back into your actual turnaround and then fix that to correspond with what the new look of the attitudes that you've just drawn. So it all kind of works together because you don't want to design your character, do the turn. It's real nice and pretty, but it's not functional. It has to be able to squish and stretch and maintain the look of the character, and that's really hard to do sometimes because the skull always stays in the same place. It's based on that sphere, which is the main part of the skull, and then you have the jaw, which moves. So even if you hold your head and you hold it, and then you start talking and moving your jaw around, you'll notice that your head with your skull does not move. It's always your lower jaw. That's the part that always moves. And so when you design a character, you have to make sure it's going to work correctly. If you design, say, a character like the Tasmanian Devil, his mouth is actually based on his whole body shape. It's in part of his body. So when he lowers his mouth, that has to fit all within his body itself. It's not kind of hanging off of him or anything like that. So these are all design considerations that you have to make in terms of when you're designing your characters. Number three, it should look as original as possible, not like something you've seen before. Now, this is the hardest thing to do of all, and we've all been influenced by a lot of the cartoons grew up seeing, and when it comes to coming up with something new, it can be really hard to get an original take on something. And the best and the most simplified designs have really been done to my mind, and we can really only do variations off of those ideas. But as far as that last one goes, everyone has a different idea of that. Now, when I sent out to design some squirrels for my Alfie cartoon, which is based on my dog and his adventures in the backyard, I had these grand aspirations to do something really new and different. And I didn't want to draw the cliche cartoon squirrel. So I did a ton of research to try and find a new approach to reinvent the cartoon squirrel. So I got a bunch of photos of real squirrels, and I started drawing them realistically first, seeing how they were constructed and how they moved. And then I started simplifying, distilling it down to their basic shapes. And by doing that, I ended up initially drawing the stereotypical cartoon squirrel. The problem was, the more I looked at photos of real squirrels, and the more they looked like that stock squirrel design to me that maybe Preston Blair did, when I tried to reinvent them and pull more from the shapes that real squirrels have, they also lost some of their appeal and their expressiveness. And also, the tone of the story got more disturbing every time I pushed them towards the more realistic. Now, more realistic drawings usually come across as evil or menacing. Cartoony squirrels make it more fun when you see them in action, so why not draw them that way? Now, real squirrels are cool looking, and they are ripe for reinvention. And I made three squirrels for my Alfie cartoon. And since there are three, they can also have their own stories and not have to interact with my dog all the time. But how to make them different from one another? I went back to the original silhouettes of the characters, and I made them all three different heights. Two of the adult ones are fairly close in size, but I made the one squirrel smaller since in my story he's young and he's kind of like the tag along. He's almost like a younger brother to the older ones, but they really aren't related. I also made one of the larger ones have a shorter tail that he lost at one point. Yeah, that way I was now able to tell the two bigger ones apart. Working with the silhouettes of the three made these easy fixes. Since seeing them in silhouette form, I could tell them apart now just by shape and size. Once I got into the actual drawings, I tried to put more energy into designing three distinct personalities. That leads to what I think is the most important law of character design, and the one that doesn't get talked about enough is number four. The character design should describe the personality of the character. Now, I'm a big believer in the idea that when you look at a design, you should get an immediate sense of what that character's personality is. It's just like in live action. Directors cast actors who are going to bring a physical presence to the role and look like what the audience expects the character to look like. There is a big difference between the types of actors cast as leading men and those who are cast as quote-unquote character actors, and they tend to be cast in the same supporting types of roles over and over and over again. People who are character actors and not leading men or women have a look and a persona that comes through that matches the type of character that the director is trying to put over within the film. People like a Steve Buscemi type or a Paul Giamatti type. That way, the director doesn't have to spend a lot of time establishing what type of character this is. When you see the actor he's picked, you immediately get a sense of what type of character this is. It's kind of a visual shorthand that helps the telling of the story. If the designs of your characters don't work well in telling the audience what type of personality they are, then you have to do all this extra work in informing the audience what they are like. You shouldn't have to do that. The best characters are ones in which the design, the voice acting, and the animation are all unified and work together in concert to create a great character from the initial viewing. The sooner the audience can hook into exactly what type of character they're dealing with, the quicker they can engage with the story and then focus on the events that are unfolding, instead of just sitting there trying to decipher what type of character they're seeing. Simple characters make it easier to get your story up and running. Now, to find a great example of this, look no further than the Disney Pixar movie Up. Everything about the appearances of the main cast is so spot on specific to their personalities, and the animation and the voice casting on both the lead characters is great. They're extreme opposites of each other in every way, which is always great for interest and entertainment. There's a real reason why the odd couple scenario has worked for as many years as it has. Now, at one point in the movie, there's an example of a character where the design and the voice are in direct contrast to each other, and it's very funny. The reason it works so well is because when you see the design, you expect one thing, but then you get another. But something like that won't work unless the design is carefully worked out, so that when you see the character, you're primed to hear one thing in particular, and then it's turned on its head, which is funny. But if the design wasn't done in the right way, the joke would fall flat. Now, another aspect to consider is the point of the movie where this happens. Now, it happens fairly late in the movie, which I think is part of the reason why it works, since all through the first half of the movie, the film has been crafted perfectly so that all the voices fit the designs perfectly. So when you come to the point where you meet a character who has a voice that doesn't match his character, it's much funnier. If a movie opens with a character who has a voice that doesn't match his design, it won't work either, because the audience won't really know if that's common or uncommon for the world of the film. As far as they know, at that point, the film might take place in a world where everyone talks in a way that contrasts their design. So in the end, a design, be it for an environment, a character, or even a prop, should always serve the story first. A cool design that doesn't serve the story is just a cool design. It's like wearing shoes made out of gold. It may look cool, but it's going to be uncomfortable, and it's not going to fulfill its primary function, which is to help you walk around from place to place. And now, as I leave you with this podcast, I'm going to help expand your imagination, and I'm going to play a 1960s Yogi Bear record. This is actually the first track. Back in the 60s, of course, there was no VHS tapes to actually relive the episodes, if you liked the Yogi Bear or any of the other Hanna-Barbera characters. And so they would re-release soundtracks of the actual cartoons on record. But they would have a narrator who would tell the listener what was happening to fill in the gaps, because you couldn't see it, because a lot of it was visual. But they would get the actual soundtrack, and of course then they would do original soundtracks with the actual voice actors doing their actual original parts, which is great. So we have Dawes Butler here and Don Messick, of course, doing Yogi Bear and Boo Boo. And this is actually a track called Big Brave Bear. And so I want you to listen to it, and I want you to imagine, if you were actually seeing this, if this was a voice track, how you would actually storyboard this, or actually do a comic book version of it. So I want you to, since you know what Yogi Bear and Boo Boo look like, I want you to listen to this and imagine how you would visually show this.
Ho hum. It was a day just like any other day for Yogi Bear. It seemed that nothing ever happened at Jellystone National Park.
You know some, Boo Boo?
Like what, Yogi?
I'm bored with this park.
I like it.
Oh, it's to like. It's a nice place to visit, but who wants to live here? Nothing never happens around here.
Calling all cars, be on the lookout for bank robbers headed north on Highway 60. Bandits believed headed for Jellystone National Park.
Yeah, we want to see the bears.
Take no chances. The bandits are armed.
Step on a jack. what's wrong with hiding out in the park, Jack?
Great idea, Mac. Don't we look like typical tourists?
Hold it, Jack. You see what I just seen?
When you seen one cave, you've seen them all.
But that cave is gonna be our hideout. Back up. This ain't bad, for a cave.
When do we eat, Mac?
Why you expecting room service? Look around.
Hey, Mac, I found some nuts.
Nuts? Do I look like a squirrel?
Well, nuts is better than nothing, Mac.
I wonder who lives in this dump.
What kind of furniture is this? Early nothing?
You be the lookout, Jack. I'm gonna grab me 16 winks.
Hey, Mac, I hear somebody.
Well, but Yogi, it's too early to go to bed.
So, what's to do that's new?
Well, see you later, Yogi.
I'm bored. That's what I am. Somebody's been eating my goodies, and they ate them all up. And somebody's been sitting in my chair there, and broke it all up. And somebody is sleeping in my bed. I said somebody is sleeping in my bed. My bed, get it?
Look out, Yogi. He's got a gun.
You're gonna get it right in the head, and you'll be dead, Fred.
So who wants old bed?
Hey, are you a for real bear?
I'm a for real nervous bear.
Gee, a really bear. Can I take a picture?
So pose, fuzzy face. Pose.
Make like a beggar bear.
Go ahead, Buster. Beg.
That's good. Hold it. Now, give me a funny one.
How about this? Hi-yo, Pinto! Away!
One more, Mac.
Coming up, Jack.
Funny! Hold still. You'll spoil the picture.
Hello!
Who that?
Hello! Anybody in there?
There's nobody in here but us bears.
Oh, that's nice. But keep your eyes peeled for a couple of bank robbers. A big one and a mean little one.
That's me.
Gee. The ranger's gone, but here comes another pest.
Yoo-hoo. Yogi. Can Yogi come out and play?
No, Yogi can't come out and play.
Okay. Bye now.
Suddenly, it hit Boo Boo. The men in the cave were...
Yikes! Yogi's in trouble.
That little stool pigeon, he's snitching on us to the ranger. We gotta blow this park pronto.
But how do we sneak past the ranger?
That bear is gonna drive us out.
Gee, Mac, you're a brain.
But I can't drive.
Details. Remember now, don't stop for nothing.
Stop? I don't even know where the brake is.
Meanwhile, Boo Boo had explained the situation to a park ranger who was stationed at the gate.
Here comes the bandit car. And look who's driving. Halt! In the name of the law! I said halt! For the last time, I said run! Hello, operator. Give me the police.
Poor Yogi. He's flipped his lid.
Faster, Fatso!
Calling all cars, the bank bandits are headed south. Beware, they are killers. Take no chances. Shoot to kill.
Me too?
Yes, you too.
Hey, Jack, look up ahead.
It's a roadblock.
Stop the car, stupid! Turn his crate around, clown!
Yogi got out just in time. The car hit a big mound of dirt, but not just any mound of dirt, a geyser. And suddenly, it spouted. The next thing the crooks knew, they were on top of a water spout 100 feet from the ground.
Turn that thing off!
The next day, Yogi was reading all about himself in the newspapers.
Brave bear bags bad guys on geyser. Ranger praises plucky bear.
How about that? I'm a hero!
Boo Boo knew better. He came up behind Yogi with a paper bag and...
You were saying, Yogi?
Don't ever do that!
And that was pretty cool. It's really hard to find those records, especially when they're scratch-free, because kids played with them back then, and they really played them a lot, and they got tons of scratches on them. So trying to find a really near-mint copy of this stuff is really hard. So I'm lucky I actually own one, which I found on eBay a couple years ago. The next thing I'm going to play for you is a track of the old Power Records. And these came out in the 70s, and this is one of the things that got me into audio and listening to audio. And it was a great thing that got me really into reading as well. And it was one of the old book and record sets. And Power Records was one of the first companies. It was a subsidiary of Peter Pan Records. And Power Records got the license to do Marvel Comics stuff. And in the second release of this stuff, they started doing some DC heroes. But the first eight were all Marvel Comics. And this is actually from the second season. It's probably the best Batman story of them all, and my favorite personally. And this Batman story is called Stacked Cards, and it features Batman versus the Joker. And as you listen to this, I want you to visualize what this sounds like. There's a great scene where Batman and Robin come up to the warehouse where the Joker is, right in the middle of the story, and you can visualize by the creaking door of the warehouse how creepy it is. And you can visualize this if you were going to draw this, because it's very hard to, sometimes when a writer gives you a script, and he says, you know, a dark warehouse down by the docks, it's creepy at night, and the fog rolls in. And it's very hard to actually draw that. There's a million different ways to interpret that. So this is another way to listen to this voice track and actually imagine what this actual warehouse is when Batman and Robin go in to see if they can catch the Joker. And especially with the creaking door. It's a great creaking door as they go in. This adds so much mood to it as well. It's typical Batman and Robin. And when you listen to it, it really does have that flavor. Because even though it was in 1975 when this was done, in terms of the general public, they still saw Batman really in the tone of the Adam West Batman TV series. And you can tell that, by the way, Commissioner Gordon has his chief, who is actually named Mulligan. But he's actually a ripoff of Chief O'Hara. I want you, as soon as you hear that, they have the red hotline phone for how Commissioner Gordon contacts Batman. And it really has that flavor of the old TV series. But when you actually saw the book that came with the record, it was actually drawn by Neil Adams. And this was actually the second time that Neil had actually drawn the Joker in a Batman story. For comic book people, the other Batman story, the first time he drew him was in 1973 in Batman number 251. And that was the famous Denny O'Neil and Neil Adams story called The Joker's Five-Way Revenge. And that's when they really made the Joker a real homicidal maniac again. And this was actually more kiddified because it was for a record for kids, but it was actually really cool, and Neil did some great visuals with the actual story. So I'm going to play that for you as well, and actually imagine what the visuals are like. Here it is, Batman in Stacked Cards.
Watch out, Commissioner Gordon. Are you hurt?
I'm all right, Inspector Mulligan. Someone just threw a rock through the window.
Sorry about that, Commissioner. You know how it is with these vandals today.
Well, that Mulligan was no ordinary vandal. Will you please hand me the note that was tied to the rock?
Oh, here you are, Commissioner.
Listen to this, Mulligan. I'll read it to you. It says, Batman and Robin, I have escaped from Arkham Asylum, and revenge will be sweet. Free once again to pursue my dishonorable profession. If you try to play your hand against mine, you will find the Joker is wild. Signed, the Joker.
Oh, that is bad news, Commissioner. I'll put out a 306 and alert the entire Gotham City police force. The Joker must be apprehended and incarcerated. Who knows what dastardly crime he might perpetrate next?
Very good, Mulligan. A 306 will be your first move. Now, hand me the hotline phone. Batman and Robin must be informed of this dire emergency that threatens Gotham City.
Hello, Commissioner Gordon. Batman here. Yes? The Joker escaped? Huh. Nothing we can do right now, Commissioner. But knowing how the Joker operates, he'll be contacting you very shortly. I'll be waiting near the hotline to hear from you as to further developments. Goodbye, sir.
Here we go again, Batman. Things were too quiet for a while. When your hotline rang, I knew it spelled trouble. Well, I think we'll get a little action now.
Right you are, Robin. The Joker has always been a real challenge. We'll get plenty of action if my memory serves me right. He's a very clever arch-criminal who must be put away. Like I said, Commissioner, the Joker doesn't waste any time. The Gotham City Museum of Fine Arts? We're on our way.
What's the pitch, Batman?
No time for talking now, Robin. Into the Batmobile. I'll tell you on the way.
Please, Batman, clue me in. What's happening?
Well, Robin, we're on our way to the Gotham Museum of Fine Arts. The Joker showed his hand. He promises to steal the famous Picasso painting of the clowns.
The museum's most valuable possession.
Exactly. It seems the clowns in the painting have a special fascination for the Joker. He wants to rescue them from the eyes of the curious who come to laugh at their image.
You know, Batman, the Joker really belongs in Arkham Asylum. He's a paranoiac who's a menace to our society. Maybe a frontal lobotomy might help in his case.
Quick, Robin, up the steps.
Right behind you, Batman.
Can I help you, gentlemen? Oh, my word. It's you, Batman and Robin. Allow me to introduce myself. I am Huntington Waterbury, curator of Gotham City Museum of Fine Arts. Is there something wrong, gentlemen?
We don't know yet, sir. Can you lead us to the Picasso exhibit?
Well, I don't understand. Well, please, follow me.
Mr. Waterbury, Gotham City's police department received a warning that the Joker has escaped from Arkham Asylum. He intends to steal Picasso's painting of the clowns.
You see for yourself, Batman. It's there on the wall. Everything seems to be in order. I'll double the security guards now that I know of the threat. Oh, my goodness. Look over there in the corner, Batman. One of my guards is lying there with a ghoulish grin on his face.
I'm afraid the poor devil is done for, Mr. Waterbury. Another innocent victim of this homicidal maniac. The insidious Joker has been here already. He always leaves his victims laughing.
Oh, poor Mr. Wilson. He was one of my best security men. And not too many years from his retirement pension. What now, Batman?
Examine the painting again, Mr. Waterbury. What do you see?
Why, it's not the real Picasso. This is a poor copy. The real Picasso must be found. Please, Batman, it must not fall into the wrong hands.
This is a very clever delaying tactic of the Joker, trying to fool us while he gets away with the original.
Hello, Batman. Is everything all right?
Glad to see you, Inspector Mulligan. You're just a little late. A guard has been killed, and the Picasso is missing.
The alleged perpetrator has to be the Joker.
Good thinking, Mulligan. Now, if you will excuse me, Robin and I are off to Pier 47. There's an old abandoned warehouse there that the Joker used as a hideout. Come, Robin. We'll try to head him off. You can follow us, Mulligan.
Hey, Batman, things are really cooking. I wanted action, and the Joker is giving it to us in spades.
Well, you ask for it, Robin.
Oh, wow, Batman. This place gives me the creeps. Only a weirdo like the Joker would use this dump for a hideout.
We've got to move very quietly, Robin. The Joker is in here for sure.
Now watch your step, Robin. Don't trip on anything.
Oops, I tripped, Batman. Look, it's a body.
Yes, yeah, a dead one. Look at his face, Robin. A ghoulish grin. Must be the night watchman. The Joker left another one of his calling cards.
Batman and Robin! You remembered my hideout, curse you! You'll never catch me this time! Here! Have a blast!
Quick, Robin, get behind those cases. I'm going after the Joker. I'm going to give you a lesson in art, Joker. You're such an art lover. I'll show you the art of trumping a Joker with a handful of clubs. Ha ha ha! You missed me, Joker. Now your gun is empty. Looks like you'll have to fight me on even ground, you fiend.
Come and get me, Batman. I can still use my fists. Take off, Batman.
Here's one for you, Joker. Many happy returns.
He's getting away, Batman. He's running toward the end of the pier. Holy cow, Batman. I smell smoke.
Quick, Robin. Turn in the fire alarm. This maniac has set fire to the warehouse. I'll take care of him. All right, Joker. I got you now. Where's the Picasso?
Not so fast, Batman. I'm diving off this pier, and when I do, you'll never catch me. I was captain of the swimming team at Arkham. What a race! Here goes! Help me, Batman. I'm stuck in the mud down here.
I forgot to mention it, Joker. It happens to be low tide. For a slimy character like you, you should feel right at home.
Where is he, Batman? Where is this monster?
Take a look over the edge of the pier, Mulligan, and see the stew our friend the Joker has got himself into this time. He should be easy pickings for you.
All right, boys. Bring a ladder. Go down and get him.
Here comes Chief McDowell and the Gotham City Fire Department. I'm going into the warehouse and get the Picasso.
Come back, Batman! Batman, you can't go into that blazing inferno!
The water break! What are you doing here?
Did I hear Batman just went into that building to save the Picasso? Oh, my, Inspector Mulligan. Do you think he'll make it?
He's an amazing individual, Mr. Waterbury. If Batman sets out to do something, rest assured it will be done.
Here he comes. Hooray, Batman, you made it. You saved the picture.
Here you are, Mr. Waterbury, the real Picasso. Careful, it's a bit warm.
Thank heavens you're safe, Batman. Oh, this picture is hot. Well, who cares? It's safe. Let me inspect it more carefully. Ah, yeah. It's perfect, perfect. How can I thank you enough, Batman?
The look on your face when Batman handed you the Picasso, Mr. Waterbury, says more than 1,000 words.
Speaking for myself and Robin, I should like to say it was done for the true lovers of art who appreciate the work of a genius. If this arch criminal had gotten away with the painting, its loss would have been felt by posterity.
All right, boys, put the cuffs on the Joker. Bring him down to the station house.
You may have me under lock and key for now, Mulligan. I promise you someday I'll escape again. They call me the Joker, but remember, in the game of life, the Joker is wild. Goodbye for now, Batman and Robin. We shall meet again.
Well, there goes Chief McNally and the boys. Looks like the fire's under control. All's well that ends well.
What do you think, Robin? Did you have enough excitement for one day?
Oh, wow, Batman. You're too much. I'm afraid all this excitement has worn me out completely. I sure hope they put the Joker away a good long while this time.
Robin, knowing the cleverness of this artful dodger, who can say for sure? Perhaps a frontal lobotomy would be the answer. If science could operate on this distorted brain and put it to good use, society would reap a great benefit. Come, Robin, into the Batmobile and home.
Now get out of here and go draw.